The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? It's Thursday. It's the podcast. It's episode 73. My God, can you believe it? How are you? What? Okay, well, look, if things aren't all right, just sit with them, all right? Don't let those people who say, cheer up, might never happen, maybe it has happened, but that's all right, it's fine. Just deal with it in your own time, okay? Sorry? What did you say? What's going on with you, Craig? I tell you what's going on with me. Last Friday, I jumped in the car and I made a 320-mile round trip, meeting Griff, just to record two episodes. Just two. 320-mile, my God, I was knackered for the weekend. But I tell you what, it was so worth it because it was a part two bonanza. One with Steve Evarts. And I tell you what, you're going to love it. It is. It may even be better than the first episode. I mean, look, I left the episode crying with laughter. It's a brilliant episode. And then I went to meet the one and only Joseph Gilgan. And you know how I always talk about people and it overwhelms me with people's beauty and honesty on the podcast. I think Joe's part two, it takes it to another level. I mean, this is soul-bearing stuff and it's inspiring stuff. So hold on to your socks for that. It's not going to be soon, but it'll be within a month, I would say. All right. So just let's keep things calm. Let's get back to the job in hand because this is episode 73. And I was thrilled that we could meet up with the mighty Olivia Cook. Now, Olivia, she just got off a plane that morning and she came to meet me and Griff in London. And surprisingly, she wasn't knackered. She was all right. She was on great form. And we just got down to it and we nattered and she's brilliant. Now, look, you're going to know Olivia from loads of stuff. Most recently, you'll know her from Vanity Fair on ITV. If you're in the UK, if you don't, you'll definitely know her from Steven Spielberg's Ready Player One. You'll know her from Me and Earl and The Dying Girl. She's been doing fantastic independent films. Thoroughbreds, which was amazing. Or the series Bates Motel. Obviously, this being the Two Shot Podcast, we don't really talk about work. But I tell you what, you're going to know Olivia a damn sight more after this episode because she's incredible. a few more things, but I'm going to get to them at the end. So stick around. This is episode 73 of the Two Shot Podcast with the brilliant Olivia Cook. Enjoy.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Oh, fantastic.
We started.
We have started.
See, that's seamless.
Seamless
it is. See, the commitment that you've shown already by flying all the way over from America just to come and do this podcast speaks volumes.
It does, doesn't it?
It does.
My character and my just how good of a human and how great I am.
So let's talk about that for about 5 hours, about how great you are as a human. How are you? You all right?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm a bit fucked.
When did you get in? Yesterday?
This morning.
This morning?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you came in yesterday.
No, this morning. Which is fine, because usually I sleep on planes, but this time I didn't, because I was, like, going over my head. I was like, what am I going to say? And it was really, really annoying me, because I was just having these conversations with a pretend you in my head.
And then, look, it's bad enough having the real thing, let alone a pretend me in your head. That's terrible. No wonder you didn't bloody sleep.
No, it's fine.
But you're not worried, you're all right? You're not concerned?
I think, like, probably, maybe it'll make me more vulnerable and open. Oh, sorry.
Look at that.
Thank you.
See, it's all about the sound.
Producer Griff just came in and gave us coasters.
Playing some little coasters on the table because he really cares about the sound. But apart from being knackered.
Oh, yeah, I feel good, actually. I had quite a reflective weekend where I was like, oh, God, the year's ending. I'm flying back to London. This year's been actually really lovely.
Do you do that every year towards the end?
No, because I find that I'm quite negative and I'm always...
As a person?
Yeah. Oh, I'm not negative, just pessimistic. And so I'm just always kind of like protecting myself from being too overly excited about things. But on reflection, this year has been, it's been really, really lovely and great.
And have you been bobbing about everywhere this year or have you been based...
No, I've been bobbing about everywhere. I did a lot of promoting this year, so like a lot of just... going to places for like 24 hours and then talking about yourself.
And then fucking off again.
Yeah, the same stories.
Do you find that all right? Or is it the repetitive questions that you find difficult?
I mean, it's fine. I just find it mentally just...
Draining.
Yeah. Just talking about yourself, talking about, you know, the three anecdotes that you have and then pretending to laugh every single time when your co-star tells you that same story and you're like, oh my God, that time was amazing, you know. But no, I mean, there's worse things in the world, isn't there?
And do you think that becomes part and parcel of, because I always think you don't finish a job until you do that, until you do the press and the interviews, because it doesn't really finish until that ends.
Yeah, and I remember, because I promoted something this year that we'd shot 2 years ago, so I don't really remember. My brain's like a sieve, like I don't remember hardly anything, like, or any anecdotal hilarious things that happened, and if they were hilarious I can't really talk about them because
they were private and it happened
exactly.
That moment and it's not for you and it's not going to help sell the film or whatever it is.
I remember the producer coming to me when we were filming being like, remember what just happened here, remember it, because then you need to talk about it. And I was like, okay. And then I've forgotten what we did in that moment to make her say that.
But it is really hard to do that because you put all your time, your effort and your energy into that 3 or 4 months or however long it is.
Yeah.
Then you have a massive break and then you have to go and pick up and remember it.
Yeah, and you're not yourself anyway. You're just this like version of yourself that you want to be and also that they want you to be as well. So you always come away feeling a little bit grim.
Do you find that hard, trying to be a version of what somebody else would want you to be instead of 100% being yourself in those situations?
Yeah, but then I feel like, I don't know if you feel like this, but I feel like I'm a different person to everyone that I'm with as well, nearly everyone that I meet as well. There's always like a different version of me that they're getting.
Well, I suppose so, because you adapt to your surroundings.
Yeah.
And you empathise with who you're with.
Yeah, and I suppose different people bring out this comfortability factor in you, but you don't get that when you're doing like junkets. You feel very exposed, and I always feel like they're trying to put me into a corner or ask about the Me Too climate and if I've ever been raped on set. You know what I mean? And so, yeah. Like navigating those questions all the time, especially this year, has been a bit. So I just want to talk about me just prancing around on set and saying lines and
talking
that's
about
it.
The story.
Yeah.
Some people can try and get a bit too personal though in those situations.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I know, yeah, it's weird because then you try and like answer it really respectfully, but they've already got an angle in their head on if it's print especially.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Which is why obviously talking to me is something completely different.
Oh, I know, it's amazing.
Because there's no angle.
Yeah.
It's just to get a version of a human.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, which is nice because I feel like, I don't know, there's been a lot this year I just did some interviews last week and I read them a couple of days ago and just completely misquoted and every fact is wrong and just like, oh.
That's
and hardly
me.
Anyone, yeah, and hardly anyone reads them, but I'm just like, oh, I can't be asked anymore.
Do you go back and read them?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, I would love to say that I don't Google myself or like read reviews and stuff like that, but I can't help it. It's so odd that I think that I'm in this job anyway. So then if there's something written about me, then I can't. I'm like an addict. I have to read it, which is really bad and really bad for my mental health because, you know, I think then I'm really influenced by these people's
opinions. Do you think it does influence you in any way?
Oh, absolutely, because then I'm like, they're right. Even if it's a shit review, I'm like, they're so right, they know better than me. Which is annoying because, oh, sorry.
But then even if it's a good review, it affects you.
Yeah, and I'm like, I am brilliant. Way. I am a revelation. I'm kidding, no one's ever said that about me.
Talk to me about Oldham, because you don't live there anymore.
No.
You're firmly quite based in Brooklyn, aren't
yeah.
you?
Yeah. Yeah. Although I think moving back here next year.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because I eventually want to, if I get enough money, eventually just buy here somewhere. So yeah, moving.
Would you come back to London if you moved back?
Yeah, yeah. I don't think I'd go back to Manchester because I've not lived there since I was 18. So I think when people ask me about, oh God, Manchester's such a cool city, I'm like, it is, and they're like, you know, where the places to go, and I'm like, oh God, I don't know anymore.
It's forever changing.
Yeah.
I mean, me and him go back a few times a year, traveling around, recording with different people, and we do end up a lot in Manchester.
Yeah.
Because some people are really kind to us and they give us little bases
where
we can record.
Yeah.
And it means it doesn't cost us anything and then people can come to us.
Yeah.
And we see Manchester change. I've seen it change loads this year. From a few months here and a few months there, and it's, oh, well, that wasn't there then.
Yeah. I know. And when I go back, I just go to visit my mum in Royton, in Oldham.
And is that where you grew up in Royton?
Yeah. And my mum's still in the same house that we grew up in.
Tell me about growing up in Royton.
It was really, I mean, it was fine. Single mom, my sister's 5.5 years younger than me. Didn't want it for anything, but yet didn't have a lot of money.
When did your mum and dad part?
When I was 6 and my sister was 6 months.
Do you have memories of that?
Yeah, my mum sitting me down on the sofa and saying, your dad's leaving. And I remember just bursting out crying because I thought I had to go with him.
Right.
And then she was like, no, you're not going anywhere. I was like, all right, that's fine. Callous. But he'd also had a bit of a tumultuous relationship, so he'd left multiple times.
Did your dad not sit down and have a word with you and say, that I'm going, or was it just...
No, my mum. Or what I can remember. But yeah, very clearly remember my mum sitting me down and... Yeah, but...
But you felt comfortable that you were staying with your mum?
Oh, yeah. So relieved. Thought I had to go and leave this lovely house that my mum had, you know, made hers and decorated really nicely. And when my dad would take us on holiday, my mum would redecorate my room And yeah, she's just such a darling. She's so sweet. So yeah, my mum's wonderful.
Have you always had that strong relationship with your mum?
No, I think it was quite hard when I was a teenager, and then Eleanor was prepubescent as well. My sister's hilarious. Remember once when she was 11, and we're, you know, it was like team estrogen in the house. And my mum one time, they were fighting on the landing. I remember my sister, she must have heard it off the TV, but she was like, "Mum, just shut up, I can smell your thrush from here." And I was like, oh my, I just fell to the floor. It was the funniest thing. And she was 11, she just heard it off the TV. So it was a lot of that. It was a lot of like, it was a lot of scrapping, but all from love. And also I had, I was always at Oldham Theatre Workshop, so I was always out the house.
And
so
when did you start there at the workshop?
When I was 8.
When you were 8?
Yeah, because it was in the Royton Town Hall. And so I'd already done ballet. My mum put me into ballet at like 2.5 because I was potty trained, so they let me in. don't know how that correlates, but yeah. I remember my teacher called me bossy once, and so I was like, "Mum, I don't want to go anymore," when I was like 6. And then did gymnastics for a little bit. And then Oldham Theatre Workshop was in the Royton Town Hall, so it was like a 5-minute walk from my house.
And was there nothing catering for you at school within that?
At that time, I was at primary school, and I don't know if they had like a drama department. I think they did.
Apart from like your nativities and stuff like that.
Yeah,
which I'm sure you did.
And like hymn practice on a Thursday when you'd sing like the Oliver soundtrack.
That's perfect.
I mean, it was great. Yeah, it was wonderful. And we had Mr. Johnson, who was always on guitar and on piano, and he was lovely. But yeah, when I was 8, I think this was the first thing that I was only 8, but remember immediately just being so inspired, or having these feelings of inspiration for the first time, and seeing all these people that were older than me, because it was a mixed group. And
also that Oldham Theatre Workshop's got such a massive reputation,
yeah,
and so many brilliant people have gone through
that. Yeah, and a lot of people that you've had on your podcast as well. Yeah. And David Johnson wasn't there anymore, but it was this guy called James Atherton, who's still there, who runs it with his wife, Sarah Nelson. And just remember him being like so talented and warm, but icy, and you really had to earn his affection. And I was just like, I just wanted to be in. And I met all my best friends there. And it just taught me a sense of community, as well as social skills
and discipline.
And just taught me how to play and just have fun. And it wasn't, even though you auditioned for the summer shows and the Christmas shows, and that was an ordeal, and ringing up and seeing if you've got in, and just the absolute sheer terror. I remember one time I wore a skirt to an audition because I just bought a skirt from Primark and I was really into it. And it was so stupid because I remember James ringing me up. And how old was I? I think I was in year 9 or year 8. And he rang me up and he was like, "Never, ever, ever wear a skirt to an audition again. I nearly didn't let you in, Olivia. Nearly didn't let you in." And I was like, ah. And then that was a running joke for a while. Me wearing a skirt to audition.
How tough is he?
He was quite tough, but
obviously it stuck with you right from today.
I know.
Some trousers.
Trousers, never been in a skirt since. he was quite tough, but in a really lovely, disciplined, measured way. It never seemed out of order.
Those inspirational teachers, and it was a teacher, you know, for want of a better word, they are quite tough. The ones that you respect and you look up to.
Yeah.
Because if all of a sudden they just roll over, then he's going, "Oh, well, I don't really respect you and you're not going to respect me."
Yeah. And he was incredibly talented as well. He played piano, he scored all the musicals, he wrote the songs. And then we kind of like devised a show, musical, whatever it was, around Sarah Nelson, his wife's writing.
Right.
So it was just such a wonderful double act.
And they're still running it now?
Yeah. Yeah.
And can you remember, because you know, I've spoken to loads of people all around, and they say, you know, for the younger ones nowadays, you know, the 14, the 16-year-olds, there's not a lot for them to do anymore.
Mm.
But the great thing is that the Oldham Theatre Workshop's still going.
Yeah.
And I know Nottingham, the television workshop, does a lot of stuff and doesn't charge people, young people, a lot of money.
No, I mean, they still charge. I think it was like, to do a full summer show, which was like 4 months, 8 hours a week, and then you do a show for a week, and then there was like 2 weeks rehearsal before that, and then there was like this mental 24-hour rehearsal that we did. I think that was like 90 quid.
But you see...
But it's like for 4 months, like look 8 hours
that,
a week.
Look at that amount of time. That's a long period of time. That is an accessible amount of money. People
absolutely
could find that, right?
Yeah, and you could pay in instalments as well. Yeah, it was wonderful. And I never really thought, I've only really thought about the money now. But I remember at the time thinking, because my mum and dad, you know, obviously would argue over money. And because they were together and were expensive. But they were, you know, I remember at the time being like, oh God, it is a lot of money, 90 quid. But really, in hindsight, to have like essentially a babysitter for 8 hours a week.
Yeah.
It's not, it's, I mean, it's, if you divide it up by week, it's pittance.
And for you to be sort of nurtured and inspired in that amount of time, it's nothing. Because I had a small discussion with somebody who I think's great on social media. And it was a private thing.
Mm.
But they'd made a comment about a television... acting for television workshop, right?
Mm.
And it was over the space of a weekend, and they were selling early bird tickets, right? Which means these are a bit cheaper, so get in now. And I've never heard of any of these people, I must admit. And it was something like, I can't quote this, but it was in this ballpark region, of about £180.
For a weekend?
Just for the weekend, right? And that was, they were saying they were the cheaper tickets. Now, when some children can't even afford, like, bus fares to get to certain places, and you're asking people to stump up that amount of money for people who, no disrespect, I haven't heard of.
Absolutely. You don't know their credentials, and they're just exploiting...
I don't think it's right, and I don't think it's fair. And it seems to me that things like that can be all about the money.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it just... It feels like this... Maybe I'm generalising a little bit too much, but it feels like this strange American mentality of all this desperation in people now to just be famous for famous sake.
Yeah.
And I just think it's really ugly, and it's not about the art, and it's not about the community, and it's not about nurturing who you are as a person.
No.
You know, and harvesting that in order to give to a specific medium. And yeah, it's just, and what can you learn in a fucking weekend?
Well, exactly. You can be spoke at for a few hours.
Circle each other, same words.
Well, exactly. And what's that going to do? It just kind of worried me that some, you know, people can get exploited very easily.
Yeah.
And I always go back to places like Oldham and Nottingham, which I know are constantly finding... it's hard to get money from the community and help. But if places like that shut down, then where else would people go to really start?
And to these places.
And with more and more, you know, drama classes at school going, oh, well, they're secondary. They don't really mean anything. Let's not have them at school, or let's cut them down to once a week or once a fortnight. It's kind of not on. It kind of gets my blood boiling.
Absolutely. And I remember... there was a few times where we protested outside of Theatre Workshop, and the local news was brought in because the council was willing to shut down and, you know, either, you know, repurpose the building. And, yeah, it was always, like, it was always really frightening, because a lot of us, like, you know, hundreds and hundreds of children and adults were just like, where are we going to go?
What are you going to do?
What are we going to do?
Where are you going to learn?
Yeah. I genuinely don't know what I would have done if that time hadn't been taken up by Theatre Workshop. I don't know what I would have done. I certainly wouldn't have been the person I am today, and I don't know if I would have been doing this job.
No.
And it's funny, because I think with David Johnson, who I then, when I was 18, actually went and did a few classes with him, and he's brilliant. When I got my first job, but James wasn't nurturing these people in order to get them into TV or film or theatre. If that happened, then great, but it was definitely more community based and having a safe place for these young children, these eccentrics, these outcasts, these misfits to really explore themselves.
And play,
yeah.
Because it sounds like you speak very passionately like about the workshop, and that really comes across. And I'm just wondering, did school kind of take a bit more of a back seat?
Absolutely. I remember when I got into year seven and just being like, oh, my God, I've got 5 more years.
On the prison wall.
Just like scratching it down. Yeah. And I could just see it before me. It was just this never-ending road. And I just, I didn't like school. Oh, I was just, fuck, it was cold. I was bored all the time. I think I was clever and I got by, but in that sense that I just didn't try anymore. And I was a bit disruptive and a bit.
Why were you disruptive?
I don't know, actually. I think actually in the first 2 years of secondary school, which I didn't realise would be so horrible. Like, kids are fucking horrible and kids are really, really cruel.
And oh, yeah, you didn't know that.
No, you come from junior school and no one really gets bullied in junior school.
A different kettle of fish, yeah. Though, isn't it? Everybody changes.
And then suddenly you're 11, 12, and you all get put together, all these other competing junior schools get mashed together. And, I think year nine came around and I was just sick of being unpopular. And so I got a sweepy side fringe, and I remember that changed everything because then everyone else got a sweepy side fringe. And
trendsetter.
Yeah. And I think I got a boyfriend as well and got drunk on Lambrini at 13. And I think these popular girls at school found it hilarious because I was just a mess. And obviously they've been drinking since they were like two. and so I was a bit of a... I think they thought I was... just a bit of a laugh to have around. And then I just started, just being a bit disruptive and just being a bit more theatrical in lessons in order just to get approval.
Were you one that was
actually, my mum tells me a story. She was like, Olivia, I got a call from your maths teacher and she wasn't very happy with you. And I was like, all I did was breathe. And then apparently the maths teacher was like, yeah, but she does it like this. From it being asked to do something.
So yeah. You were acting very young then. You were already acting in the classroom.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. I think I knew I knew how to get a rise out of teachers, but in a way where I knew when to stop.
You knew your boundaries.
I knew boundaries, but there's a lot of people, there's a lot of boys that, would make a teacher cry and then you'd be like, that was already always a horrible...
He's usually the supply teacher in our school.
Yeah, always. Or they'd come into the class and you'd be like,
oh, not those.
It's not me, it's you. Who's doing that?
I remember a whole class doing that once. And I think because they saw it on Grange Hill and then they repeated it. Don't repeat it the next day, but let's wait for a week and then we'll all do it and everybody has to do it.
Grange Hill.
Oh, it's got a lot to answer for.
It does, doesn't it?
That and heroin. Poor Zamo before your time.
Yeah.
You don't remember Zamo, do you?
No, I don't.
Look up Just Say No, YouTube.
Oh, Just Say No. Yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah.
I do remember that. But...
So did you think... Were you thinking at that moment, not at that moment, around that time, you were so passionate about the workshop and that was kind of taking over your life, that this was something that you could do for a living?
No. No, I remember at 14, because I was... the friend group that I made were all a year older than me, so they were always all starting thinking about auditioning for drama school. And I was just going to follow in their footsteps because I didn't know what else to do.
Yeah.
I remember at that time of year, feel so massive and I would copy them a lot because their humour and their wit was so much more elevated than mine at that point. And so anything that they did, I wanted to do. And my best mate, Sam, and we're four best friends and we're all still... best friends now, which is wonderful because I feel like I met my people there rather than at school, and school was just something that I had to do to kind of pass the time.
Of course.
But at 14, my best mate Sam had been acting a bit. He was in Shameless and he did The Street.
Right.
So
you were seeing... That's the thing, because some people go, well, I never saw anybody on the telly who was like me that I thought, oh, well, if they can do it... But you see, around that time, we had those people. Remember when there was a time when all you could see was northern people on the telly?
Yeah.
Everything was about the north.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was very sort of on trend to be from the north.
Right, it was all coming out of, like, Beverly Keogh's office. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That was the hub. The Beverly Keogh's was the hub.
Yeah, she got me my first job.
She did? Yeah. I didn't know that, yeah.
But he had an agent, and so I was like, fuck it, I want an agent too. I didn't know what an agent was. I was, like, picturing these, like, men in black agents. And then...
Well, they are a bit like that. I'm joking.
I mean, who knows? And then I was like, I'm going to audition, because it was open auditions. Then I auditioned and it went horrible. And they didn't put me on the acting side, they put me on the commercial and modelling side. They're like, for now, Olivia, yeah.
Right. And was this in Manchester?
This was in Manchester, so that PHA.
Right.
Yeah. But then still carried on with the workshop and also...
And were you still at school at this point?
Still at school, yeah, I was 14. And it just felt like that hurdle of, like, getting an agent felt like all I needed to do. To prove to myself, and I remember that was enough, because I remember, like, a boy that I really fancied texted me being like, oh my god, just heard you got an agent, well done. And no one really knew what it was, but it just sounded dead cool, you know.
But it was the next step, it was the kind of the natural next step for you there, really.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, I wouldn't have got started if I didn't have that agency in Manchester, or if I didn't have my best mate Sam, or if I didn't have workshop where I met my best mate Sam.
The influences that were all around. Was your mum supportive of what you were doing?
She was until I quit sixth form, and she was like, Olivia, 99% of actors, 99% out of the work. No, 99% of actors are out of work 99% of the time. And she was like, so you what? So you're just going to work in McDonald's for the rest of your life? Because I didn't have a plan B and I didn't have any qualifications.
Oh, was the GCSEs that...
Oh, well, I had my GCSEs, but do they count for anything?
I don't think they do.
Yeah. But, yeah, I quit sixth form.
What were you going to be doing in sixth form?
I was doing psychology, English lit, performance studies and drama. Performance studies and drama were two separate things. So I was like, yeah, great.
Right, it's another two.
Yeah, exactly.
And why was the quit? Why was the enough is enough? I'm quitting now.
I would just started working. I got my first job when I was just turned 18, and just couldn't handle the studies and also working at the same time. And then I was kind of given an ultimatum by one of my drama teachers, who said, "You know, actually, the really weird, really weird thing seems like these jobs will come time and time again, but you can never get back your education." I was yeah, no, exactly. I was like, I think you can. So, yeah, then I don't think I'm a, it was really hard for me to sit still and just let, and just absorb these teachings. I find it really difficult. And also, I don't think I applied myself massively.
Well, no, obviously not, because your heart wasn't in it. And if your heart's not in it, then you're not going to do it. It's like, I was talking to somebody the other day about they accepted an acting job that their heart wasn't in it, and they knew that they shouldn't have said yes.
Yeah.
They could tell, like, from the gut, and they went, and then I just had to suck it up and just get on with it, but I knew.
Yeah.
And if your heart's not in it, then what's the point?
Yeah, but I think, especially at that time, it felt so momentous, this decision that I was making. It was like life or death.
Mm. Well, it's kind of a big deal at that age. Yeah. Well. Especially if you're getting pressure from all sorts of people.
Do you go to drama school?
Yeah.
Where'd you go?
Mountview when I was 17.
Oh, Mountview. My friend Dan Flanagan went to Mountview. Did you do musical theatre?
I did. Well, I got accepted on the acting course. Mm. It's not about me, Olivia.
I know, but I wanted to know.
Don't turn this around.
No, but
me.
I wanted to know, because you say in your podcast that you went to drama school, but you never say what.
It's because we never talk about it. That's right, we'll cut all this out.
Oh,
no, I'm joking. What I did is I got accepted on the acting course, and then... I went to the third year graduation of the acting course, and there was not a lot of people turning up. There's not a lot of agents turning up.
Mm.
Then I went to the graduation of the musical theatre people, and there was nearly every agent there.
Really?
From all sorts. all sorts of people. Like, why do you think that was? All big agencies. I don't know, but I think it was predominantly a more successful... that time, it's changed very much, and I've been back since, and I'm going back again this year in 2019.
Oh, nice.
See what I've done there?
Yeah.
and they've moved to Peckham, and the head of Mountain View now, Stephen, is all over it, and the students are incredible. But I think at that time, it was more known for its like its musical theatre.
Right.
And as it's well documented, I can't really sing a note. But what I did was I acted the arse out of it and said, oh, can I move on to the musical theatre course?
Did you?
Yeah. Because I thought, well, if I'm going to get any chance, just I need like a decent agent.
Mr. Cellophane.
So, oh, I did one. That was one of them. They're on there.
Just what's
the
monotone.
What's the ones that talk a lot? Yeah, I have one of them. Yeah. Brilliant. What's the one where I can try and make someone laugh? Ding, I'll have one of them. And then I did that because I was trying to think of two and a half years down the line, do you know what I mean? And then, yeah, it kind of all worked out.
That's good.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Well, thank God.
Was it a lot of money then?
Well, I was at the end. Why has this suddenly turned on to be
I don't
money?
Know.
You're skilled. You should start a podcast. This is good. No, I was at the end of, I was in the last year of a grant.
Oh, really?
So I got my fees paid, which was the main point. And then I don't think I got any maintenance. So I ended up just doing a lot of work.
Right.
So I'd work in Pizza Hut. A lot.
Right.
But then I would
and just
make,
stink of that dough.
Stink. But then I would also be quite popular because I would take a lot of
dish
free
out pizzas
home, make a lot of mistakes with the orders. And then just go on the way home, where's your pizza? That's for you, that's for you. Anyway.
Oh, yeah. That's cool, though.
Where are we? What? So your mum wasn't too happy about you leaving sixth form?
Mum wasn't too happy because I think also she'd provided a life for me and my sister where where she just, I mean, she didn't have a lot, but she gave everything to us and just wanted to make sure that we were always going to be all right.
Mm.
And I think embarking on this really unstable career where I think at the time I was like turning auditions down for, you know, not Grange Hill, Waterloo Road and like Hollyoaks and stuff. Because in my head I was like, no, I don't want to be a soap actress. Just because I've got this accent, I'm not going to be a soap actress, you know?
Yeah.
Which I really also admire people that do that because it's fucking so hard.
Jesus, I was talking about that as well not long ago. The workload.
Yeah.
I've known people on them. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. No, you have to be so super talented and also, you know, you're not giving the best scripts and so to make them that land and to make that believable every single day is fucking feat. But yeah, I was like a snob even then.
Yeah, but you're much younger then as yeah. well, you know.
But so my mum was just really
worried.
Oh, yeah,
she was being a mum.
Yeah, she was really worried.
What was your relationship like with your dad at the time? Was he around?
Yeah, he's a bit... So my dad... I was about four because I don't think my sister was born yet and I was stood on my mum's bed and she was getting me ready for nursery. And my dad... I remember my dad... See my dad pack a suitcase and he was downstairs opening the door and I remember just shouting, am I going to get a new daddy? And then I just heard the door slam.
No.
But knew at four, manipulative, what reaction that was going to get out of my dad. Oh, God.
But it just says so much about what an effect that kind of had on you at such a young age.
Yeah, and no wonder I'm trying to and want to be an actor and want people to love me.
And want to escape into the world.
Yeah, love me, Daddy. No, he does.
But do you feel that, even now, do you feel that, I know you say that quite flippantly, that you kind of want people to love you. Do you think there's an element
absolutely.
Of you that you want people to like you?
If I can tell that someone doesn't like me or if I do something to offend someone, it plagues me.
Yeah.
I can think about it for 3 years after. I'll wake up at night and think about this thing and just like whole body regurgitation of just what I said or what I should have said or what I should have done. Yeah, it really eats away. Which is so, it's, I mean, I spend so much of my mental real estate on worrying about what I've done, what I've said, what I should have said. What they said to me, what I should have said as a retort. Oh, God. Yeah.
God, so you do worry. You really do. You are a worrier.
Yeah, but texting you, be like, oh my God, I'm going to be 5 minutes late. I'm sorry, and then end up being 15 minutes late. And I was like, he hates me. Hates me. He's going to hate me.
Absolutely not. But that's I said on the text, it's fine.
I know, but that's what my thought process
well,
is.
Well, there was, I think it was last year. And because I book all the guests for the podcast, and obviously I've got to do my day job as well, and I was doing the day job and doing this in tandem can be quite difficult because the film schedule changes and things went over. And I was 5 hours late. Was it 5 hours? It was about around between 3.5 or 4 hours late for poor Daniel Ryan's episode.
Oh.
And he stayed and he waited. And I turned up
him.
I was mortified. And still now, I think I might have texted him the other day going, I'm still upset about the fact
that
I was
late. Yeah, your bum all still clenched.
Terrible behaviour. I hate people being late for me, and I hate myself being late for anybody, especially when they've committed to do something and speak about the personal things on this, you know?
So do you feel that as well? Do you feel, do you think that's a universal performer, actor, artist sort of thing?
I know all sorts of creative people that are huge worriers. If not externally, then certainly internally. Mm. And, you know, they'll have like a stomach like a washing machine for ages. But maybe they'll feel a bit stilted that they can't say, oh, God, because I'm quite good at going, I am so sorry. But I can't switch it off.
Right.
A few days later, I'll still worry about it.
Yeah, you'll still
feel terrible.
Yeah,
even though the other person will be like, what? Oh, that? Oh, God.
Yeah, did you even register?
I haven't given that a second thought.
Yeah.
Whereas I would kind of hold that with me.
Yeah, and I think we're also quite good at holding it together as well.
Yeah, on
the surface.
Absolutely.
Value.
Yeah. Oh, really, Olivia? You didn't seem at all like that. Oh, well, I really was, actually.
I really was. I shit my pants, actually, and you didn't see. But yeah, I remember my friend Claudia, who I just worked with, and now we're really, really good friends, which is lovely. We're talking about our various mental health issues, and she was like, oh, I would never have guessed. You're so good at holding it together. I was like, because you have to, because also, like, if you, not to play like, you know, especially as a woman, but if you act up on set or if you have a bit of a wobble, then that sticks with you as well, and people talk about it because there's nothing else to fucking chat about on set, you know.
I do love a bit of
little
gossip, a little bit of chatter.
Yeah, so you have to be so amiable all the time, and it really...
Do you think you're getting better not just holding things together, but I suppose compartmentalising what you should put the effort in to worry about and what you shouldn't?
A little bit. I've got a little bit. I mean, I know I'm bouncing about a bit here, but I mean, especially this year, I've had like probably the most successful year that I'm ever going to have in my whole career, but I've spent the majority of it just worrying about the next job and worrying where it's going to come, and then worrying about, have I sold out? And worrying about, am I not honouring my fucking artistic integrity? Which is all nonsense and all stupid and all things that I've heard and taken on to a personal level because I'm a narcissist.
I always think you always come across that you just care, really. And with regards to worrying about the next job, get in line.
I know.
I think we all do to a certain extent. And I don't think that changes. It might get easier. You might feel better. But it's just the chosen career, I suppose.
I know. Yeah, and I think...
And you have had a brilliant year. But I think artistically, I wonder why you feel that you would sell out. In what way? In what respect? I certainly can't see anything that you've done.
Well, this is the thing. Like, I think I'd always play devil's advocate in my own head. So even if I'd done, you know, like one art house film, I'd be like, oh, well, I should have applied myself and auditioned for something that was a bit bigger, and now I'm not going to get a job after this because no one would have seen that fucking art house film, you know. It's all, I think, also having a lot of downtime as an actor breeds all these incessant, unhelpful thoughts as well, that I need to find a better way to channel.
And filter that out.
And filter that out, yeah, because I think, you know, traveling a lot and being on your own in a country that you're not from, and I think I just spend too much time just kind of wallowing in my own created misery when it's a complete fabrication of this whole. I've created a narrative in my head that's not actually true. So in 2019, I'm going to improve on that, and that's my New Year's resolution.
Well, I think it's fun, and you know, I know you're joking about that, but I think that's really healthy to think that positively and go, you know what, I am going to change that. I do, my downtime shouldn't be sitting and deconstructing certain things.
Yeah.
Because that's going to snowball, isn't it?
Yeah.
How is your downtime? What? Apart from sitting down worrying, what can you do? Do you keep yourself busy?
I do try and keep myself busy because I developed a bit of OCD. So if I'm just with my own thoughts for too long, then I do find that I get a massive jolt of anxiety and then can sink into a depression quite easily.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, which only started when I was 22.
How did that come about?
I think having worked consistently since I was 18 and not really fully evaluating that pressure, just kind of going on like a bit of a Trojan horse, and not a Trojan horse, just kind of like bullying my way through it, and living in another country and being homesick and just going from job to job and not really taking care of myself, I think. And then New Year's Eve, right after my 22nd birthday, was in Hamburg, and it was the most amazing night of my life. It was incredible. Never felt anything like it. And I never had a come down until like a month later when I had like a full-on mental breakdown and had a panic attack for a full like 2 weeks straight. And God, I've gone very down in town to sell how horrible my life is.
You're not saying you're just talking about it, don't worry.
But yeah, it was really, I was like, oh God, I'm going to have to be committed. I'm going to have to be locked up, because I started having all these incessant, horrible thoughts and like weird visions as well. Not like right in front of me, but in my mind that kept flashing. Yeah, I was having a full on panic attack for 2 weeks. And
did you seek help? Did you have some support?
I was in LA at the time, and
you weren't working though, were you?
Yeah, I was doing. I was working as well.
Oh my God, during this two weeks.
Yeah, yeah. I'd just finished because I did a show for 5 years. So in the downtime of that show, because I was a peripheral character, so I'd have like sometimes 2 weeks without working. So instead of staying in Vancouver, I'll go down to LA or wherever we're at mates. And yeah, I actually this really famous actress that my boyfriend knew, he reached out to her because she suffers with some anxiety and depression. So he reached out to her and she gave me like a huge list of therapist to go to, which was really kind. And so I went to one, and it wasn't right for me.
No.
I was his last client on a Friday, and talking to him, I could just see his eyes glaze
over.
He's
glazed.
Yeah. And he's just like, and that's really sad for you.
Great.
And I was like, mm-hmm.
How much?
Yeah. Right, $150
exactly.
Right there for an hour.
Yeah.
So
that's no help. So yeah. Did you try and find somebody else?
I did, but then I... But because I was travelling so much, I started Skyping someone who was in Wales, and I just got really paranoid about what I was telling her and what she was telling me back, because it felt too... And she also knew that I was an actress, and so it just felt... And also doing it through like a webcam, I just got really icky about it.
That's gonna spar you off.
Yeah, and so I haven't really spoken to anyone since. But it has subsided.
because you've taken the steps to look after yourself a bit more?
Yeah. And I think, God, I exercise a lot now, which really, really helps. And, and I know what triggers my anxiety, and I know when I'm feeling it, and it's usually, I mean, a lot of it is around my menstrual cycle.
Right, yeah.
And
how's your sleep?
Oh, great. Sleep right. is my one. I'll be anxious all the way through the day, and then I'll get to my bed and I'll be like, oh my God, I've made it.
This lack of sleep can trigger so many things in so many in different ways in different people.
Weird hallucinations and horrible
and
thought patterns.
You know, that can sink you down.
Yeah, but no, my sleep, even when I was having that 2 week spiral, I'd go to sleep every night, which is really weird. I'd just get into bed and just be like, because I think my body just needed it because it was so.
It was probably
on high alert every single day.
Such a level, the amount of time throughout the day, and then all of a sudden, if you can relax.
Yeah, it was really weird because I forget that happened now because it was just such a. I feel so removed from that time and nothing. I remember a year before that, I remember clearly being in an apartment in Vancouver and being like, God, I'm so lucky that I've never had any mental health issues. You know? I'm one of the lucky ones. I really am. And then a year later, just.
But I think anything like that can happen to anyone in any walks of life.
Yeah.
But how lucky that we're in an age where it's all right to discuss things and talk about it.
I know.
I think the stigma is less and less.
Absolutely. And I see my sister, she's 19 and she's struggled with, you know, anxiety and depression. And I think we've realised this year that it's been ongoing for quite a while and got her help and she's really turning around. And it's lovely that we can have that dialogue together. And yeah, I don't know anyone that doesn't suffer.
Do you speak to your mum about it?
Yeah, but when I told her, I was like, Mum, I've got anxiety and depression and it's manifesting this like OCD, this kind of OCD, obsessive thoughts kind of way. And she was like, what did she say? She was like, what? So you've had a bad childhood?
Right, okay.
And I was like,
thought.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, Mum. I was like, so I don't, and she was like, Olivia, I would have loved a mental breakdown, I just didn't have time.
What you think of that? That's to me just you
know. It's a different generation as well.
Well, one, it's a different generation. Two, it's the mother's guilt.
Mm.
I think.
Yeah. Yeah, was I not enough? Yeah.
Which you quite clearly were.
But also, she definitely did have time. So remember when I was 8, I think she'd just broken up with her first boyfriend after my dad. And I came into the back garden and she was just sat on the bench, like catatonic. And I was like, Mummy, you're all right? And she's like, I'm just sad. And I was like, why aren't you crying? She's like, I don't have any tears left. And I was like, and I just remember feeling like so disgusted, actually, that she divulged that information to me, my mum, who was supposed to be a pillar. And I was like, oh, and I didn't like how vulnerable she was, which is really, I mean, I was 8, so I can't blame myself too much, but.
But it's still a heavy thing to divulge to an 8-year-old.
Yeah.
Because how are they going to know? I'm just sad.
I'm just sad, yeah.
I mean, she obviously was, because to say that.
Yeah, and I didn't understand this, like, pit of despair that she was in.
Of course not. You're 8 years old. You shouldn't be able to understand that.
So I was like, actually, Mum, you haven't been depressed, so ha-ha.
What did she say to that?
Did
she agree with you? She acknowledged that maybe she has been in the past?
Or she considers it something. I think the word depressed is too big of a word for her. I think she was just sad for a period, and I'd go into the conservatory and she'd click off the radio, the cassette player straight away because she was listening to self-help tapes.
Well, how amazing that she was trying to get help. That's
absolutely,
you know, for a different generation. It's a whole, that's more or less a taboo subject. We don't talk about, they're the other people who have those problems. We're all right. We'll
plough on.
Stiff upper lip and all that. We'll just get on with it. Yeah. But it's all right. It's all right to go, I'm not in the best place, actually, at the moment.
Yeah, and I wish you did. I mean, she's fine now, and I think me and Ellie are definitely all right, but, yeah, it would have been nice for her to have some extra support.
Do you think if any of that ever comes a-knocking again, you'll be able to deal with it in a different way?
I would hope so, yeah. I mean, that's always a bit scary, I think, of dipping under again. But I think also with the way this world is, I mean, I think about just my effect on the planet all the time. Like, why am I here? I'm just one big, like, fucking landfill.
Do you ever think that with your career and you go, why am I doing this? What does this mean?
It's like, why are we having plastic bottles on set? Like, why is there so many plastic bottles? Are we recycling? You know?
Yeah.
And I just think, oh God, why? Yeah, it's just so frivolous and I'm just doing it because I'm selfish and think there's like a part of me that needs to be explored and people want to see it, you know? But then on the other hand, it feels really good.
And you really enjoy
it.
And
I really enjoy it and I love it. And I feel so fucking lucky that I get to live these characters, all these characters in one lifetime. I think it's, yeah, I think it's brilliant.
I think that's the key to stop sometimes and go, no, I am lucky doing what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And you can't control. Of course, look, we have so much lack of control about doing what we do. And maybe if you don't ever make peace with that, if you're aware of it. But it's about the control of other things. I can't control someone being on time for me.
Yeah.
So therefore, if they are late, I can't get wound up about it.
Right.
For one instance, you know what I mean? Yeah, there's many, many other things that we have lack of control over.
Yeah, absolutely. Relinquishing that power a little bit and just...
But I think that's Rome wasn't built in a day. It's an onward thing.
Yeah, it's a bit of a spiritual endeavour.
I think so, yeah. I mean, I'm not too spiritual, but I try and really think about things much more than what I used to.
Mm. Yeah, rather than just, like, going off of your id.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, if you sat with your own thoughts for too long, can easily spiral out of control.
Absolutely, and I think that's why I don't have social media or anything like that, because I think that's just a bit of a poisonous landscape for me. And I think also, I don't know, do you get competitive with an actor? Do you feel, like, jealous when someone, like, in your orbit gets a job that you wanted?
No.
No, never?
No. Probably not. No, probably I was many years ago. But not anymore. Because I can only look after me, what I accept to do or say no to as work. And if something else happens, well, that's their journey.
Yeah,
that's not to do with me. So I just have to be where I am.
Yeah. No, that's a really good way to look at it.
But it's, I've been doing this 20 years.
Right, I've been doing it 6.
And I think it's only since I've started the podcast that it's helped me in more ways than I could possibly ever imagine.
Yeah. What with talking to other people and seeing their
talking to other people and not necessarily even getting into the nitty-gritty because it's not really about acting.
Yeah.
It's not about that, really. So, it's...
But, yeah, you've taken control of your own narrative.
So. I think so.
Yeah.
Why did you end up in New York?
I was 21 doing a film in New Mexico and I'd got a job in Vancouver when I was 18 after 9 months of working professionally. And from then on was just like bouncing around America, going from job to job, would go back home to Manchester for 5 weeks and just fester with my mum, feeling like a 15-year-old again when I've just like seen the world. And
because you're going back home to your mum's house.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So and she's like, Olivia, just clean your fucking room.
You get back into that position of what you were before you did all that.
Yeah, yeah.
Excuse me.
Get your cups out the kitchen. Get your cups out your bedroom, put them in the kitchen. And then in New Mexico, doing a film and fell in love with a guy who lived in New York and still together, so that's good. So I was like, fuck it, I'll just move to New York. And I did. And then in the first year, that was really, really tough because I only knew his people.
His circle, yeah.
And he's a bit older than me. And so I was 21, so I just felt so inexperienced and so thick as well. But
geographically, you don't know the place, so you're just... You thought, well, there's the roots. I just wanted to try and bed down a bit.
I enrolled in French lessons.
Did you?
Did 30 hours of French lessons. Didn't retain any of it.
Why?
Because I was just lonely and just needed something to do. So I was like, fuck it, I'll do French lessons in New York.
At least you tried,
though. At least I tried. Yeah, exactly. But no, and I love it. And now I live in Greenpoint in Brooklyn, and it's a nice little neighbourhood. I have a really nice life there. But always, my heart's like 75% in London as well. I've just kind of moved there because then it was just easier to get to LA, and then it just worked out in terms of jobs,
yeah,
as well.
Because that's, of course, over there has been where the majority of your
yeah.
jobs has been.
Yeah,
really.
Exactly.
It's yeah. been, what, two or three here? Definitely two that I know of.
Over here?
Mm.
Yeah, only really two. I mean, Ready Player One filmed here, but it's American
well,
film.
Well, exactly, yeah.
But yeah, only two here, apart from my early work when I was 18. I did two BBC miniseries, one with you, okay. Craig, and a film, and then moved to Vancouver after that.
And how do you deal with the homesickness?
Oh, God, it really ate away, ate away at me. When I was first going over there, because I remember my first job was in Vancouver and it was for 5 months. I didn't have any money and I was hired as a local, which is ridiculous. My agent was fucking shit. So my American one, my first one. So I was hired as a local, and so I had to, my initial plane ticket they paid for, but then everything else, I had to, my flight back, I had to pay for my rent there, I had to pay for, and, you know, I didn't get a per diem or anything like that, and I didn't have any money either, because I'd done...
So it's like you were paying them to do the job.
Well, yeah, I mean, you kind of are, aren't you,
yeah.
at first. And so my mum had to, like, give me money off her credit card and stuff like that, and I didn't have any friends, and I didn't really know how to cook, and I didn't know how to, like, look after myself, because, you know, I'd never been to uni, and this kind of was my first time away from home. Yeah, and I just felt like a pleb. I just felt so obsolete, and so I just felt like a bit of an invalid. I needed my mum massively. And then when I was 18, I was like, oh, my God, my mum has done so much for me. I've given her such a hard time in my teenage years because we'd fight like cat and dog. Remember, I'd come home from school and I'd have massive period pains and I wanted to have a bath, but she needs the hot water because she's got hair dye on, and then we're having a fight and she, like, kicks me down the stairs and I'm like, no, let me in! And she's got, like, dye running into her eyes. But she's done so much for me, and it's... And, I really got... just found a new, the next level of love for my mum
yeah.
when I was over there and lamenting and crying on Skype at how much I missed her.
It happens.
Yeah.
I think it happens to everybody.
Yeah. But I'm really glad that I went through that, because I think if I'd stayed in Manchester, then it would have taken me a few more years to realise
that.
Yeah, so I'm glad I appreciated it quite early on.
And we started off, because we've kind of come circle,
sorry.
Really.
Yeah.
And you were reflecting sort of on the plane over here about the year.
Mm.
And someone would, on the outset, who doesn't know you, would probably look and go, wow, what a... And it has been an incredible... It's been a great, successful year for you. There's been
yeah.
lots of... But where does that stand within you, within your happiness? On reflection, do you think it's been a happy year for you, within you?
I think, actually, it's been a successful year in terms of things... that have come out, but I actually haven't done a lot of work, and I think I'm most happiest when I am being creative and when I'm feeding off of other people and where I'm meeting these amazing people, because you really do. I mean, we're so lucky with this job. I meet people that I would have never even dreamed of having discussions with and being
or
stimulated.
Or been to places that I would never dream about going there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I mean, a good thing about promoting this year, I went to Japan for the first time, and it was...
Wow.
Amazing. It was amazing. It was like such a cultural experience, shock to the system. But yeah, I actually haven't done a lot of work, and I feel like my soul needs to be fed a little bit by just being on set and just doing some acting and just messing about and playing, really. Because it's been a lot of just talky-talky, talk about myself, try and look good, try and make them like me. In a weird way, try and not let them have that soundbite. Oh, they got that soundbite. Shit, I didn't actually say that, you know.
Well, you're safe here.
I know. It's quite nice.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Craig.
Did you enjoy that? Was that all
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I think so. Was it all right for you?
I loved it.
Okay.
Was it what you thought it was going to be?
No. I had all these anecdotes in my head.
But you didn't feel like Spy was doing anything?
No. No, actually.
And another episode is done. I mean, she's incredible, isn't she? And, you know, we all think that we get to a certain point in our lives or our careers or whatever it is we're doing, and we all struggle, we all worry, we all have anxiety, and those things never change, but talking about it may help, and I think it does. And I can't thank Olivia enough for getting off that plane and coming to meet me in that 1970s hotel, which we laughed about. She's brilliant. And if you haven't seen Thoroughbreds or Me and Her and the Dying Girl, she's just incredible. Yeah, go check out more of her work. And also, fake competition, not really a competition, but if anybody can guess the double two-shot podcast guest link between this episode. In fact, it's a three episode. So there's three links with regards to this episode and other past guests on the two-shot podcast. Oh, you've got it. You're there before me. But if you haven't, have a think. Go back through the past 73 episodes and you probably get it. Now, look, two more things just before I go. I've just ordered a brand new load of beautiful Two Shot Podcast badges for this year. Now, if you don't know them, I'm going to tweet a picture of them this week. It's how you can help us, support us, and throw a few quid our way, but also get something in return. Show your loyalty. This is what I'm going to do. Can you hear my voice is going? It's very late. I'm tired. And also, someone was asking me this week on Twitter about live shows. I'll tell you now, there's a possibility of three live shows this year. I can't say yet because we're not confirmed. We haven't made the dates work. But when we do, I'll throw the dates your way and where they are in the UK. They are spread out. I feel like I'm whispering now. Am I whispering? I am whispering on that. Okay, well, look. That's it. Thank you for joining us. You know where we are. We're on all the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. It's at Two Shot Pod. And drop us a message there. We're twoshotpod@gmail.com. If you want to do an email, always welcome. And we'll see you next week. And I'll have a better voice. Until then, thank you so much. Please do me a little favour. Yeah, okay, great. Make sure you hit subscribe. You don't have to listen to everything. Just hit subscribe. Maybe there'll be episode that'll surprise you. I know there will be. Hit subscribe. Give us a little iTunes rating. Yeah, do the stars. And if you want to write something beautiful, then you can do that. Write something horrible. Yeah, probably don't do that. That'd be nice. It all helps, okay? And until next week, thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you next Thursday. I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been producer Griff. And this has been the Two Shot Podcast. You take care. I'm slightly croaky. I'm going to have a lem sip. Take care. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.